that requires pharmacies to ensure that all legal prescriptions are filled, even if a particular pharmacist has a personal objection.
That's Congressman Carolyn Maloney talking last week about the Access to Legal Pharmaceuticals Act. We're going to be talking here in the first 25 minutes of the program about that act, about a lawsuit that's been filed in Illinois against Governor Rod Blagojevich. He made an emergency edict about how pharmacists should be dispensing the morning after pill. We'll be talking about all those issues here in the first 25 minutes of Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Welcome back to the program here on Monday, June the 13th. The month is almost half over. Before we begin our conversations today, thanks to St. John's Lutheran Church in Wheaton, Illinois, for hosting day one of our Issues Etc. Reformation Tour last week. To Christ Lutheran Church in Oak Park, Illinois, for hosting day two. And, of course, Elm Grove Lutheran Church had day three of the Issues Etc. Reformation Tour last week. It was great to be in Chicago and the Milwaukee area for those 3 days of broadcast. And thank you for tuning in and listening as well. Well, it's Monday. We're back in the studio. Bill Beckman joins us here in the first 25 minutes. Executive Director of Illinois Right to Life, and also Ed Martin of Americans United for Life. We'll be talking to them in just a moment. Coming up at 3:30, Doug LeBlanc will be our guest. We're going to be talking to him about forensic theology. He's author of a story in the latest Christian Research Journal titled Forensic Theology from Waco to the Middle East to Utah. That'll take us to just about the end of the first hour. We'll pick up near the end of the first hour with Bob Alico, spend about 25 minutes talking with him into the second hour about, well, I think this is number four, if I'm not mistaken. No, number five, sacred cow number five of the Word Faith Movement. Is it God's will always to heal Christians? He'll take on that sacred cow there. And then from 4:15 to 5 o'clock, leading up to the third hour, a review of Joel Osteen's latest sermon. He's talking about, well, not so much overcoming adversity, but passing the test. We'll find out what Osteen means by that. In the last hour of the program, you want to stay tuned for Hour 3 of Issues Etc. Today, we had opportunity while we were in the Chicago area last week to visit Willow Creek Community Church in South Barrington. We stopped there on the way up to Milwaukee, walked in. I'll tell you what happened when we went to Willow Creek this last week. In the third hour of the program, it's open lines for your questions and your comments. Our call-in numbers for all 3 hours, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Bill Beckman joins us as Executive Director of Illinois Right to Life, along with Ed Martin, Attorney and Director for the Center for the Rights of Conscience at Americans United for Life, to discuss whether or not Illinois pharmacists should be forced to issue the morning after pill. Bill Beckman, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi, Todd. Thank you.
And Ed, welcome to you as well.
Thank you, sir. Good to be with you.
Let's start with you, Bill. What is the issue here in Illinois, the local issue, when it comes to the morning after pill and Illinois pharmacists?
Well, it appears that the starting point for this is actually, I think, orchestrated by NARAL and Planned Parenthood, because on their websites they have things indicating that they're basically going after pharmacies. NARAL says, tell pharmacy chains to stop discriminating against women, and Planned Parenthood says, take action, fill my pills now. And they orchestrated an incident that they claimed that women were being denied their morning after pills by pharmacists, which was actually fabricated in the sense of the way they went to exaggerate it, because they said that the pharmacist even kept the prescription so they couldn't go anywhere else to get it filled, which was totally false, as it turned out, based on a validation that was done by a family pack. And so they created this incident, and then they convinced Governor Blagojevich to issue this rule that demands that pharmacists fill these prescriptions.
What kind of authority does the governor's rule have over pharmacists?
Well, his administrative agency that deals with professional regulation issues rules for various regulated professions, and this is one of them. So he's able to issue this kind of rule. And now to get it to stick, he's got to manage to get it to be made permanent. And that happens apparently after a 150-day period of commentary and further discussion on it. But it sounds like he's planning on moving in that direction.
Ed, tell us about Luke Vander Bleek and his suit and Americans United for Life's part in it.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm happy to do so. Luke Vander Bleek is a healthcare professional. He is a pharmacist by training and by career choice. But he's also someone who became an entrepreneur a few years ago. He decided to go into business for himself, and he bought and actually now owns four pharmacies. And so he combined both his love for his work and an entrepreneurial spirit. And he's a very good, just a nice guy and a family man, children and wife, and active in his church. He's quite a singer, actually. CNN did a piece on him last week, and he was singing in his church. It's interesting. But so he's plugged along in Western Illinois. He's made a nice living for his family. He's a good member of the community, really well-liked. And one thing he has said is that he will practice his healthcare profession, the piece of that which is who he is as a pharmacist. He does work in his own pharmacies and as a pharmacy owner. So lo and behold, on April 1st, the governor changes the rules. Basically, he puts out an emergency rule that attempts to override the law of Illinois and the practice of Luke Vanderbleek and his pharmacies in Morrison, Illinois, and a few other towns. So Luke is not a, you know, they try to paint people in this movement, pro-lifer, so often they try to paint all of us as extreme and rash and all this. And what we have with Luke Vanderbleek is a man who he took about 5 weeks. He said he prayed about it, he thought about it, and he just came to the conclusion that he had no way to continue to practice pharmacy and own a pharmacy with this rule on the books telling him that he had to violate his conscience. So that's kind of when Americans United for Life and myself met up with him. And he has sued the governor saying, look, I practiced my business and my healthcare profession based on the laws and the rules in Illinois. There's an Illinois Healthcare Rights of Conscience Act. The Illinois Rights of Conscience Act. And he said, I did this, and now you're trying to change the rules. That's not only unfair, and by the way, as a lawyer, I can tell you it's an overreach of the governor's power. It's an affront to anyone who cares about government being smart and decent and going through the regular rules. But it's an overreach of based on who I am as a man, Luke Vanderbleek. So we're asking the judge to make clear that the emergency rule is null and void and allow good Christian or religious or whatever, whoever, men and women who have a conscience that says, I don't want to destroy life like this, to allow them to practice their healthcare profession.
Ed, very briefly, you made it clear that with regard to pharmacists, Illinois law as it stands, notwithstanding the governor's emergency directive, does allow men like Luke Vanderbleek to refuse to dispense at a prescription, something like the morning after pill.
That's exactly right.
Are doctors in any way required to prescribe the thing?
No. I mean, let me tell you two things. I know your listeners, you have a pretty sophisticated listenership, and I think the distinction will be helpful, and I'll be brief. You know, we all as Christians or religious people would have a moral question about what we can allow our conscience to do, and that doesn't leave us when we go to work. But there's also just the legal question. What does our society limit? Illinois has one of the most expansive rights of conscience protections for all healthcare providers. It says if you're in the healthcare field, period, doing any kind of healthcare procedure, you are protected to object based on your conscience and not be penalized for it. That's juxtaposed with other states, including Missouri, for example, where there'll be protection for healthcare workers, but only around the abortion procedure in a healthcare setting. So Illinois has this expansive right that the governor has now decided to abrogate. I mean, it's incredible.
So according to the law in Illinois, just to sum this up, just because a doctor has no qualms of conscience about prescribing the morning after pill, a pharmacist does not have to dispense that at the doctor's prescription.
Well, and this is a reason why a show like yours is helpful and others, is that we lose in America our understanding of decision-making and how our conscience is informed by what we do. A pharmacist is considered a part of the health. The answer to your question is yes. And the reason is the pharmacist is considered a healthcare professional in the stream of healthcare. And when he or she makes a decision to dispense, they use their conscience because they have to make a decision. Is there a contraindication? Is this the right dosage? Is the patient in some strange position that they shouldn't be given it? Or am I morally opposed and so I can't be a part of it? That's part of conscience. And so, yes, a doctor may say, oh, Plan B or emergency contraceptive or the morning after pill, and a pharmacist has the right under the law to say, oh, I don't want to participate in that, and step out and not be penalized for it.
We're talking with Ed Martin. He's an attorney and director for the Center for the Rights of Conscience at American United for Life. Also, Bill Beckman, executive director of Illinois Right to Life. Gentlemen, Congressman Joe Crowley, he's a Democrat of New York. He says that women shouldn't be denied birth control or morning after pills because of their pharmacist's moral or religious objections. Here he is.
If someone is against contraception, that's fine. They don't have to alter what they believe. They just have to let those who want access to have access to contraception.
Bill, I want your reaction first.
Well, this kind of logic path has been used all along in terms of effectively when they tried to force medical schools to teach abortion, they used the same logic path, and that's what generated some of these laws, including this good one in Illinois that Ed has already mentioned, to try to make sure that the law doesn't or that the professions don't get forced to practice things that they have moral objections to, and that applies just as well to this as it does to abortion itself.
And Ed, how would you respond to the congressman's contention?
Well, first of all, I think that the politics of this is really disappointing. The governor and, as Bill alluded to, the national players, NARAL and NOW and others, have clearly this has been done for political gain and not there's not an access issue. There really is not an access issue, and it's a trumped up charge. So that gentleman, you know, the congressman yammering on about it seems to me to be disappointing. I will say this. The reason why this battle is being fought over stuff that is called quote unquote contraceptives end quote is because that if you poll out there for Christians, Catholics in particular, non-Christians, they will say oral contraceptives, the birth control pills for women, everyone thinks, you know, 85% of people will say that's acceptable. I don't want that limited, including many pharmacists, by the way, including Luke Vanderbleek, actually. His pharmacies will sell birth control. But the reason why it's being done, and this needs to be shouted from the mountaintops, is this is preparation for shoving RU486 and the morning after pill and other things like it down the throats of Americans through this right to carry or duty to dispense, where people will now say, hey, we've already fought this fight. Pharmacist, you have no right based on your moral beliefs to say RU486 is a good or bad thing. The FDA approved it. You have to give it. And that's where we're headed. That's why they're calling it contraceptives. It's an easier way to fight the fight.
Let's get your reaction to something that Karen Pearl had to say on this issue. She's the interim president of Planned Parenthood of America.
We defend everyone's right to make their own moral choices, but women's health must come first. And contraception is necessary, basic health care for women.
Ed, your reaction again? Well, she uses the word contraception.
Yeah, I mean, it's a red herring, and it's a little shake and bake. But you know, the bottom line for her and for the effort is, you know, they don't want to talk about other people's rights. They certainly don't want to talk about the rights of either an embryo or a fetus. Obviously, that for whatever reason, you know, that doesn't raise the level. But more importantly, as I said, and I debated her on NPR, and it, with all due respect, she's an interim president, and I think there's a reason why, because she did not handle it well. And one of the things that I cornered her on is there is no right to health care in America. You cannot command others to give up their rights, in other words, a right to conscience, without some other trumping right. And if she wants to create the right to health care in America, she needs to go out to state legislatures or the federal government and create the right. It has not, as Bill said, it has not been done so because, you know what, health care includes abortion, and there is no right for you to tell me, an OBGYN, to do an abortion. There's no right like that. And she loses all the time. But anyway.
Isn't this essentially, I mean, legally, completely as a non-attorney, a very similar issue to a doctor who simply says, look, I'm an OBGYN, I'll deliver babies, I'll do prenatal care, I'll do the whole shebang, but I will not perform abortions.
Well, I think it is, and I'll tell you, though, if you had someone on the other side who wanted to counter you on that, they would tell you that the pharmacy owner or pharmacist is further down the line in healthcare, and they would draw a distinction in terms of the provider. But I do think that for our listeners and people thinking about it, a right to conscience, our conscience is who we are. To go against our conscience is to go against who we are. It's like, you know, the ultimate would be if someone said they're a believer in Christ and someone said, now deny Christ. I mean, look to the scripture on this. That's the ultimate way. You go against who you are, you become less than human in a sense. Well, the conscience for all of us, including pharmacists, including doctors, pharmacy owners. It's the center of our being. And to now have legislators running around saying, I'm taking that away from you, pharmacy owner, I'm taking that away from you, it's very disturbing. These are not the moral arbiters, people that I would like making these calls, frankly.
Okay, here's a personal story told by an Illinois woman, Luciana Fortune Bass, and she's talking about her attempt to fill a friend's prescription for the morning after pill.
The pharmacist began to tell me that myself and the young lady was a murderer, and that she would not return the prescription because she would not commit murder, and that my soul would be condemned to hell.
Bill, was this the orchestrated incident that you mentioned early in our conversation?
Yeah, I believe that that is something that's been, at this point in time, established as being a total fabrication. It didn't happen. And the fact that they're willing to go to this kind of extreme to generate the news so that they can justify their position just demonstrates how desperate they seem to be in terms of trying to make an issue out of something that really wasn't an issue. I mean, people had access to this. The issue last year was that they needed to have it over the counter. Now this year the issue was that since they couldn't win that one, that they're now going to try to make the foreign pharmacists into bad guys because certain pharmacists choose not to dispense it. I mean, it's so totally ridiculous in how they're taking this.
Ed, your response to the story that's been told about, and I think the impression is, at least there's an attempt to give the impression that this is happening all over the place. Pharmacists are not only not prescribing it, but keeping the prescriptions and then preaching to their clients.
Yeah, well, I guess the best thing is to go back to Luke Vanderbleek, the pharmacy owner in Western Illinois, and to tell you his policy. His policy for his four pharmacies is someone comes in with a prescription for Plan B or any of these objectionable of drugs. He does not dispense them, and he asks his pharmacist not, and he hands back the prescription. He does not refer them to another place. He does not, you know, send it down the block to him. He doesn't do any of that because he thinks that would be participating in a way that's inappropriate. He hands it back, and he tells the person, I won't fill that. It's not our policy. If the person, confidentially, if the person wants to engage that reason, he will confidentially explain his position based on how he understands the science and his morality for him as an owner of the store. Now, I think that happens to be a very kind way to do it. And are there people that will at times be harsher? Of course. I mean, there are people when we go to buy a hamburger that are sometimes very professional and sometimes very curt. But having said all that, one's right of conscience does not stop when you become rude. And my impression of America, although we can be coarse, is that most people that are in pharmacies and are in those positions are not preaching, they're not hectoring, they're not lecturing. It's a little too dramatic for me. And again, even if they are, they still have a right that should be protected. If you want to object to that, pass a law that says you can't speak to, you know, people after the fact of denying their prescription. But that, again, that's a free speech thing, and it's a bit trumped up.
All right, now I'm curious about the whole over-the-counter attempt here, and I'm wondering, first of all, Ed, if the proponents of the morning-after pill had succeeded in making it an over-the-counter, non-prescription drug,
mm-hmm.
it would be very hard for them to argue that pharmacists who say, oh, well, I'm just not going to carry it, I won't even put it on the shelves, that they have to do that. It seems like they're at least legally in a better position with this thing still being a prescription medicine.
Well, that might be right, actually. But, you know, it also puts the, according to the rule now, one of the ways to solve this, that in Luke Vanderbleek's consideration and when he met with me and other lawyers from Americans United for Life, one way to solve it was maybe stop selling contraceptives of any kind. If you read the rule that the governor did, it said, if you sell contraceptives, you must sell all of them and dispense them without delay, something like that. And he thought, well, I could sell none of them, and I could sell no condoms, no birth control, no nothing, and I would be out from under the rule. And you know, that might solve it. But again, I have a question I just want to ask. When did we let the governor start indicating that he could abrogate, you know, existing law and change the rules here? What we have is a healthcare professional trained to be a piece of our healthcare, you know, arguably the best healthcare system in the world. And one piece of it is this pharmacist who is not just a clerk, he is a healthcare professional, asked to engage their decision-making and be a piece of the puzzle. Now we're saying, oh, we don't really trust you, we don't want like the system, whatever. It smacks of desperation, really.
Ed, very briefly, where is this lawsuit headed, Luke Vanderbleek's lawsuit?
Well, We're in Whiteside County Court, and we will hopefully have a hearing in the next month or so. And we will slog it out. Litigation can take some time. We expect to be fought every step of the way. Bill does bring up an interesting and important point. The emergency rule was promulgated on April 1st for 150 days. Then it automatically must either sunset or be made permanent, and we're kind of waiting for that. Most people think it will be made permanent. A lot of us pray that it will sunset and maybe go away, but we'll be seeing around September, early September, when that rule comes up between now and then, whether decisions made on that.
Bill, any pending legislation in the Illinois legislature having to do with the life issue we should be aware of?
At this point in time, you know, the good thing that went through was the Born Alive Infant Protection Act, which is now on the governor's desk for signature. And virtually all of the bills that would be, you know, viewed by us as anti-life were managed to be stopped, or at least they were not brought for a final vote in one house or the other based on a lack of votes to pass them. And so now we're waiting for the fall veto session to see if there's any attempt to bring any more of them up. Otherwise, that means we'll have stopped them this year.
And any pending legislation on the pharmacist issue?
At this point, there is no legislation I'm aware of. There was another attempt to make it over the counter, which failed in committee, so it didn't get out of committee, and therefore that's basically pretty much dead for this year.
Bill Beckman is executive director of Illinois Right to Life. Their website, illinoisrighttolife.org, illinoisrighttolife, all one word, .org. Bill, thank you very much for being our guest.
You're very welcome.
Ed Martin, thank you for being our guest as well.
You're very welcome.
Ed Martin is an attorney and director of the Center for Rights of Conscience at Americans United for Life. Their website, aul.org. Very simple, aul.org. When we come back from this break, here in the second part of our first hour, Doug LeBlanc is going to join us. We're going to be talking with Doug about something called forensic theology. Now, before you say, that sounds a little bit like CSI, it does, and it is. How important is it for investigators of crimes that have a religious component to understand the religion? Let's take, for instance, the Branch Davidians in Waco, Texas. How important was it for people pursuing that, even before the great tragedy and the fire down there, pursuing them under criminal charges, to understand what the Branch Davidians really believed, what they meant when they said the kind of things they said to the FBI, to investigators in the press? It's called forensic theology. Doug LeBlanc will join us here in just a minute or two to talk about it. He's author of a story in the latest Christian Research Journal titled Forensic Theology from Waco to the Middle East to Utah. Then Bob Lico joins us to round off the first hour and into the second hour. He's been doing this series on Sacred Cows of the Word Faith Movement. Today we are to the Sacred Cow number 5, which is, it is God's will to heal you all the time. Everybody will have Bob respond to that. Then from about 4:15 into the third hour of the program, a review of Joe Osteen's latest sermon. In the third hour, well, last week when we were in Chicago, we had the opportunity, about an hour and a half, to go visit Willow Creek Community Church in South Barrington, Illinois, one of the most influential megachurches in the United States. Did we get a chance to meet Bill Heibel? No. It was, I don't know where he was. It was an interesting visit. It was impressive and unimpressive at the same time. And we're going to be talking about it in the third hour of the program, along with your questions and comments, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Martin Luther writes this: next to the preaching of the gospel, in which God speaks with us and gives us all his grace and blessings, the highest and foremost work we can do is to speak with him through prayer and receive from him what he gives. By our prayer, we seek and find what we are to receive. While many books claim to be about Christian prayer, or to offer a form of prayer, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June, a Lutheran Book of Prayer, is a genuine prayer book. Prayers, psalms, and other resources for your daily prayer life. To order a Lutheran Book of Prayer, call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, or go to our website, issuesetc.org. 1-800-325-3040. Ask for the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June, Lutheran Book of Prayer, or our website, issuesetc.org.
While God's word is spreading like wildfire throughout Brazil, this Global Minute asks you to pray for an indigenous people group who have never heard the name of Jesus. They're known in Brazil as the Oxum Incas and are descendants of the Incas of the Andes Mountains. This people, even the children, still use the cultural robes of the Andes, which are woven from wild cotton and dyed brown from a jungle bark they're boiled in. They have their own distinct language and primitive culture. A longtime missionary to Brazil is not letting the fact he's headed toward age 70 quench his desire to learn another language, the language of the Oxum Incas, so he might share about Jesus and his love with them. Please pray these Brazilian Oxum Incas will soon hear and be open to the gospel of Jesus Christ. Blaze a trail where no missionary has ever tread. Learn of unreached people groups through missionvisionnetwork.org. It's a resource for you and your church. That's missionvisionnetwork.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Compromise leaves me feeling unsure about myself. Take meetings, for example. Surprise! People around the table do not think your idea is the greatest thing since sliced bread. Most often, your thoughts get lost in all their opinions. Or, if someone does hear you, you get something like this: "Well, that'll never work." The eventual outcome is often compromise. You change your opinion, somewhat or sometimes totally. And after you back off, do you find yourself silently taking a multiple-choice test? A. I really don't know anything. B. I have no backbone. C. All the above. So my eyes opened wider when I read this from Jay Conger in Managing People. He says too many managers see compromise as surrender, but it is essential to constructive persuasion. Compromise good? Even when biblical truth is debated, which we believe is non-negotiable, could listening and questioning make our presentation of God's truth more persuasive? But for the rest, for today's meetings and conversations where earthly things are discussed and where our opinion doesn't carry the day, what's it going to be? A. You are reminded that you are not a God-anointed carrier of all truth. B. Love your enemy, the guy who shot down your idea. C. Don't take yourself too seriously. D.
Would you like to support AM850KFUO and at the same time let others learn about your church? Well, why not become an AM850KFUO Church of the Week sponsor? Your congregation will be mentioned in every hourly station identification, and during the week there will be 35 announcements giving your church's address and phone number. Plus, Paul Clayton will interview your pastor on the morning show. To become a Church of the Week sponsor, please contact Jeff Craigmeyer at 314-725-3030.
Well, it was some years ago, but we all followed the great interest tragedy down in Waco, Texas, with the Branch Davidians. Now, how well did everyone, investigators, FBI, police, law enforcement, government, understand what the Branch Davidians were saying when they said what they said in the press to investigators and elsewhere, what the Branch Davidians believed? We're going to talk about forensic theology here in this 25 Minutes of Issues, Etc. Doug LeBlanc joins us. He's a freelance journalist and author of a story in the latest Christian research journal titled Forensic Theology from Waco to the Middle East to Utah. Doug, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Thanks, Todd. Always good to talk to you.
Define the term for us to begin with, forensic theology.
Well, forensic theology came to my attention through an article in The Atlantic, and in The Atlantic magazine, it is very clearly presented as a way in which theologians or other academics help law enforcement authorities either solve crimes or identify whether a threat or a statement legitimately comes from terrorist groups or doesn't come from terrorist groups. But in looking further into the story, I also found a scholar at St. Louis University who uses the same phrase to refer to offering his expertise to the courts, especially on issues of church-state relations. So it's a pretty broad term in that respect. I also found, I don't mention this in the story, but in researching the story, I found a fellow in England who claims to have coined the phrase, and he used it in reference to exorcism and delivering people from demons. I was unable to reach him for comments, so I didn't go into that angle.
You quote Nancy Ammerman,
right,
who has written a book called Armageddon in Waco, and she talks about one of the fundamental failures of authorities and law enforcement to understand the Branch Davidians and what they were saying, especially their religious terms. Tell us about it.
Well, yes. Nancy Ammerman was one of a few different contributors to this book called Armageddon in Waco. And my friend Terry Mattingly has long told me that federal officials, especially from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, had not consulted with scholars at Baylor University who knew the Branch Davidians or knew their thinking and had, I think, even had some conversations with them and some dialogue, if you will, and could have been of great help to the law enforcement authorities. But instead, the authorities were relying on scholars at a much greater distance who had less direct contact with the Branch Davidians. And so it appears they probably acted more hastily than they had to. With some greater consultation of the authorities at Baylor, they might have prevented things from going quite as horribly as they did.
I'm curious how far this discipline of forensic theology would span. You mentioned the Branch Davidians. You mentioned looking at Al-Qaeda statements or alleged Al-Qaeda statements. What about, the story came over through the weekend, this fundamentalist Mormon group, the leader of which is being indicted for polygamy. Would there be a role for forensic theology in this investigation to say, okay, what is it this guy really believes about polygamous marriage in the context of Mormonism, since a crime is being committed, or at least alleged to have been committed?
Oh, yeah, it's a great question. And Frank, Mr. Flynn at St. Louis University, who I interviewed, I think is one who engages it somewhat, because he talks about his feeling is that if the Supreme Court had not ruled to outlaw polygamy through its decision in U.S. versus Reynolds, that these offshoots of polygamous offshoots that consider themselves the true Latter-day Saints faith and consider the major LDS church in Salt Lake City to be heretical, that they may not exist. But of course, that's a genie that that we can't put the toothpaste bag in the tube on that matter at the moment. Franklin Flynn, though, the same fellow who makes that critique, he believes that the Supreme Court may one day reverse itself or reverse the previous ruling from some time ago and somehow find a way to make polygamy legal within the United States to accommodate Muslim immigrants who are polygamous. It's not at all to say that even most Muslim immigrants to the United States are. But to answer your question a little more directly, I think in the meantime, scholars who have studied polygamous groups could certainly shed light on how the leaders of these groups really take their beliefs very seriously, and they see themselves as practicing the laws of God, especially as they understand the Old Testament and its depiction of so many people who leaders who were polygamous. And so I'm sure that for most polygamists, the threat of going to jail for being polygamous would not stop them from doing it, because it would be as reprehensible as asking a pro-life evangelical to stop protesting on behalf of the unborn, you know, to make a comparison.
Doug, who are the best resources for the practitioners of forensic theology and law enforcement? Ammerman says in your article that professional theologians are not necessarily the best resource. Why?
Oh, yes. That's because Professor Ammerman believes that professional theologians a lot of times are trained to talk within the discipline of their own church and to be apologists for their own church's theology. And so she would say that you're often just as well off talking to professors of religious studies who have a good, broad understanding of the topic, but less of a vested interest in taking sides. I would think, though, that, for instance, in studying polygamous offshoots of the Latter-day Saints, that it may not be a bad idea, you know, to consult some professors at Brigham Young University who would know something of the history of polygamous thought and why the Mormon Church itself eventually repudiated it.
Tell us about the nexus between forensic theology, the study of religion when there is a religious element involved in crime, and terrorism, in particular statements or alleged statements by Al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups.
Well, the group that is really doing outstanding work on that, at least as indicated by the Atlantic Monthly, would be a group called the Middle East Research Institute. And this is another case where I was unable to obtain comment from the man who leads it. His name is Yigal Karman. He's the co-founder of MEMRI, as it's called for short, M-E-M-R-I. He's a former chief anti-terrorism advisor to two of Israel's prime ministers. And the article in the Atlantic Monthly talks, for instance, about how MEMRI would use simply sometimes the vocabulary of a message to show that it was not truly coming from Al-Qaeda. Here's a direct quote from that article. Among other things, yet this message termed the 9/11 attacks events rather than raids, which is a translation of the early Islamic word ghazwa, and talked about foreign agents, a word common in the vocabulary of nationalist ideology, whereas bin Laden and his followers typically call their enemies infidels. And it also referred to attacks in Madrid as messages, a word out of keeping with the way bin Laden casts his operations. So it's a fascinating case of simply knowing the language of Al-Qaeda, and it's comparable, I think, to we all hear that that saying that people who work in banks, you know, learn to identify counterfeit bills by spending a lot of time studying the real thing.
So in other words, bin Laden and Al-Qaeda steeped deeply in the language of Islam.
Mm-hmm.
Their messages can be discerned through forensic theology as a and distinguished from things that claim to be from bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. But on just the difference of simple words, they can say, look, this is not what bin Laden believes. This is not what he would say if he were issuing such a message.
Right. And I would say steeped deeply not only in Islam, but a particular radical form of Islam that would be, I'm sure, unrecognizable to a lot of practicing Muslims around the world who don't believe that the best way to bring about God's will is through those kinds of attacks.
Finally, Doug, talk about the connection between First Amendment religious freedom rights and forensic theology.
Well, that also returns us to the realm of Franklin Flynn, who teaches at the University of Washington in St. Louis, and he became involved in forensic theology and that particular expression of it when he was called on to defend the Hare Krishnas and arguing that they represented an ancient religion in the sense that they are putting forward Hindu theology, and that they're not simply this modern cult that sprang into existence in the 1970s, presumably out of the head of a Hindu deity or something, you know. So it's a helpful. It was a really refreshing thing to get to know Franklin Flynn and to interview him by phone and to see how a believing Catholic would apply his understanding of other religions to really have a keen grasp of the importance of freedom within the realm of church-state separation. When he speaks of church-state separation, he's not talking so much of the church meddling in the state. He's more often talking about the state meddling in matters of the church and matters of courts, you know, being called on to somehow rule on what orthodox theology is and how that can be a pretty dangerous precedent.
Doug LeBlanc is a freelance journalist and author of a story in the latest Christian Research Journal titled Forensic Theology, From Waco to the Middle East to Utah. Doug, thanks for being our guest.
Thanks for having me on.
Our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June is a unique prayer resource. It's called a Lutheran Book of Prayer. It really is a handbook for daily prayer. Now, what makes it unique? First of all, it is historic. It has prayers from the 16th century Reformation up until today. Now, this is a newly revised edition of a Lutheran Book of Prayer. It's $8.99 plus shipping and handling. What else makes it unique? It is Lutheran. That is, it is steeped in the truths of the 16th century Reformation, grace alone, faith alone, scripture alone, for Christ's sake alone, and that forms the basis, the skeleton, for sound Christian prayer. It's called a Lutheran Book of Prayer. It's $8.99 plus shipping and handling. For more information, just go to our website, issuesetc.org, or order the book by calling Concordia Publishing House in the next hour and 10 minutes, 1-800-325-325. 1-800-325-3040. Ask for a Lutheran Book of Prayer. Make sure you mention Issues, etc. 1-800-325-3040 or our website, issuesetc.org. For the remainder of this hour and into the next, Bob Leko joins us. He's a regular guest on the program. He's a former Word Faith pastor and graduate of Robert Tilton's Bible School, and he is also a co-founder of Discernment Ministry International, based in Detroit. He joins us to talk about God's will and physical healing, part of an ongoing series we're doing with him on the sacred cows of the Word Faith movement. He'll join us here in just a minute. Then, from about 4:15 until the 5 o'clock hour, we'll be reviewing Joel Osteen's latest sermon. After we've dealt with this fifth sacred cow with Bob, you might want to listen carefully to that Osteen sermon for hints of his Word Faith background and his Word Faith teaching as well. Then in the third hour of the program, we took a visit to Willow Creek last week when we were doing our Issues Etc. Reformation tour in Chicago and Milwaukee. I'll tell you what I saw, what I heard, and what happened in the third hour of the program, along with your questions and your comments. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Bob Leko has authored an article in the latest Truth Matters newsletter titled Sacred Cow Number 5, Is It Always God's Will to Heal? Bob, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Well, thank you, Pastor Todd.
Okay, first of all, could we say that there is a connection between all of these sacred cows we've been dealing with, the view of positive confession, that is, you confess your way to prosperity, you confess your way to, if you want to, to a lack of prosperity, positive and negative confession, that God himself exercises his own kind of faith? Is there a connection with that and one of the strong emphases of the Word Faith movement, personal healing?
Oh, absolutely. Everything hinges on their concept of faith and confession. Those are the linchpins through which every blessing you're going to receive as a believer is going to flow. It's based on finding a text in the Bible and then believing that in your heart and confessing it out of your mouth until it becomes a reality in your life. The sad thing is, Todd, is that most of, well, actually all of the major Word of Faith teachers, and that would include Kenneth Copeland, of course, and Joyce Meyer and Jesse Duplantis and many of the others that, that people are familiar with, the sad thing is that they have no understanding of what it means to look at a scripture in context. For example, I think it's in Amos where Mr. Copeland quotes that God will give you cleanness of teeth, and he confesses that for having good dental health. But the actual context had to do with God sending a famine upon backslidden Israel. But they will take a sentence or a passage and claim that as a promise, and you know, in essence, hang the universe on that and stand upon it until they get their manifestation. And if they don't, then of course the problem is not with God's word, but with the fact that they only had a head knowledge versus a true spiritual revelation. And this is very true for all of their claims of physical slash faith healing, that they believe that, you know, it is God's will, indeed, for all of us to receive.
Is there anything wrong from the historic Orthodox Christian position, as opposed to the word faith position, is there anything wrong with praying for and even expecting, on the basis of God's promises, healing for illness or disease, Bob?
Absolutely not. In fact, I kind of went to great lengths, I feel, in the article that I wrote to assuage anyone's doubts concerning this. We believe that Jesus Christ is still a healer. And as a Lutheran, which I am, there's no conflict with that belief and certainly Orthodox Lutheran doctrine. In fact, the good doctor, Martin himself, taught that God can and will, according to his good pleasure, heal people through the right reception of the body and blood of Christ at the Lord's table. And I cite an example of that where Martin Luther talked about that. You know, we tend to focus on the negative aspect where Paul rebukes the Corinthians and says, hey, many of you are weak and sick and some have died because of their ignorance and mishandling and misunderstanding concerning the body and blood of Christ. And Luther turned that around and said, but you know, on the other hand, we shouldn't shy away from the table because there's a blessing there. And God can, in fact, renew and restore us physically through the right and proper understanding of the Lord's Supper. So, no, as Christians, certainly we believe that God is certainly capable, and he does, in fact, heal people according to the good pleasure of his will. The difference between the Orthodox view and the Word of Faith view is that the Word of Faith cult has made this a guarantee. They've made this a principle, a law, a spiritual, I'll just call it a law, that if you do A, B, and C, it will always equal divine healing. Well, that's simply not the case, and there's no biblical support for such a belief.
How is weakness, sickness, disease, we might use the word in general, infirmity, or a lack of health, how is that viewed among Word Faithers?
Well, they would look at that in a variety of ways. Number one, they would look at that, let's say in your case or my case, if we should be stricken with some type of illness, we have given place to the devil, either through a negative confession, perhaps we have not been tithing on the gross, perhaps we've been speaking negatively about the pastor or other leaders, and somehow we've opened a door, we've opened the hedge that God has set around us as a believer and allowed the enemy to come in and attack us. That's one way. And now that these Word of Faith teachers, of course, are getting older, they're recognizing the fact that there is a need for good nutrition and a little bodily exercise, and things of that nature, so they may look at that as a possible reason why people are ill. But it always boils down to the believer. The individual themselves have caused the illness or allowed the devil to come and bring the illness upon them. Marilyn Hickey likes to quote out of Proverbs that the curse causeless shall not come, and they certainly view sickness as a curse. And so if someone is sick, there's a cause for it. Now, we may not be aware of what that cause is, but, you know, we need to really spend time in prayer and fasting and praying in other tongues to discern what has, you know, caused or given place to the enemy to bring sickness upon us.
So is it safe to say, Bob, that it is standard word faith teaching that illness, disease, infirmity, I imagine that you would have to include among that injury, deformity, even congenital deformity, these kind of things, are all the personal responsibility of the person inflicted with it in one way or another. Unless, of course, they're one of the word faith teachers, then that's just the devil doing his best.
Well, yeah, absolutely. There's a double standard that goes on there. For the rank and file member, the lowly sheep, if you will, the low wattage believer that's trying to attain the high level of faith that, say, a Creflo Dollar or Mr. Copeland or someone has, they get sick. Well, that's because they've sinned. But when you're one of the big shots, like a Joyce Meyer, who admitted on television, so it's record, that she had breast cancer, and she was going to believe God for her healing, but her family talked her into getting medical treatment, and so she said, well, you know, I just went ahead and, you know, agreed with my family, went ahead and got medical treatment, but, you know, I was going to believe God. In that case, that was an attack from the enemy trying to stop, you know, the tremendous revelation and the forwarding, if you will, of the kingdom of God through these men and women. So you have a double standard going on. You and me, it's sin, bad confession, unbelief. For them, well, it's a direct attack from Satan, such as with Jan Crouch. She had cancer, several bouts of cancer, and through medical treatment, she, you know, at this point is cancer-free, and I rejoice over that. I don't want to see anyone suffer. But her reasoning for her deliverance medically, of course she gave God the glory, which she should, was simply because God wanted her on the planet to continue to give toys to the poor children of Haiti. That was the reason why the enemy had attacked her, to stop her from giving these toys out to these poor children.
Now let's take a break here, Bob, and when we come back from our break, we'll continue our conversation with Bob Leko on the Word Faith movement and its contention that it is always God's will in each and every case to heal the Christian, if, of course, the Christian will do his part, which is a significant part. It's pretty much all up to the Christian. When we come back, more with Bob Leko and the Word Faith movement. Stay tuned.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.